the 1996 Farm Bills. Since joining the Institute at the University of Missouri, he has studied Europe, Africa, and Latin America. In addition to his responsibility with the Institute, he is a research associate professor at the Department of Agricultural Economics at the University of Missouri, teaching classes in ag policy and the market. Dr. Wetzel, floor is yours.
So as you can tell, we're switching gears here quite a bit. I do want to thank everybody for the invitation to be here today. I'll make a deal with you all. If you all withhold any economist jokes, I won't show any supply and demand diagrams. Is that fair trade-off here today? Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about the linkage between ethanol and energy markets. Talk about petroleum fuel markets affect ethanol markets, how ethanol markets affect agricultural markets, how policies greatly complicate all these relationships, and then how agricultural and biofuel affects energy markets themselves. So here's kind of a key point for the discussion today. Just looking at data since going back to July of 2007, the red line is going to be the price of petroleum, the blue line the price of corn. And especially between July 2007 and about this time last year, there was an incredibly strong correlation between those two prices. As you can see, it kind of appeared to break down a little bit in the late last year, early this year. But now we're back kind of in the same relationship we were just about a year ago. So what's going on there? What's causing what? So we'll try to talk about today. So what might be some of the links between these things? Well, one thing that's been true forever, at least for a very, very long time, decades, is that fuel and other corn production expenses are very closely tied to prices for petroleum and other energy and other fossil fuels. But there are also some common external factors that affect both corn markets and petroleum markets. So for example, global economic growth will affect both the corn market and will affect petroleum markets. Exchange rates will affect both of those things. But of course, what's new in the market that's really, really important now and will be important probably for decades to come is the impact of ethanol and how it's a key linkage between those markets. So let's walk through some numbers here quick. This is a relatively simple table. This is just showing you what corn production expenses were in 2008 based on USDA estimates. And you see fertilizer is about $139 per acre of a total cost of operating cost of $295. When you throw in all the land and other overhead costs, the total cost is about $529. So fertilizer is a very major part of that. Fertilizer, of course, as you well know, is closely tied to values for various fossil fuels. In particular, nitrogen fertilizer will be tied to natural gas prices closely. Fuel, and electricity, $43. Agricultural chemicals, $25. All those are costs that are tied to fossil fuel prices. The higher the price of fossil fuels, the higher the cost of producing corn. Higher the cost of producing corn in the long run, higher corn prices are going to be. But that doesn't necessarily make prices of corn change from day to day or year to year. It's more of a long-term effect and probably a relatively muted effect, frankly. So what are some of the other things that could be going on here? Well, of course, as I mentioned, there's other factors that affect both corn markets and petroleum markets at the same time. And exchange rates would be one example of those. So for example, between July of 2007 and July of 2008, the US dollar got weaker against a lot of other currencies. That made our products more affordable in other countries, would have led to higher prices for corn, higher prices for lots of other agricultural products. At the same time, the weaker dollar also contributed to the run-up in petroleum prices that we saw. Those things all reversed themselves in the last half of 2008, pushing down prices for both corn and petroleum. But I don't want to get carried away here, because look at the scale of these things. These are all based with July of 2007 equal to 100. You'll note that the change in exchange rates is far, far smaller than the change in either corn prices or petroleum prices. So by itself, it can only explain a small part of what happened during that period of time. So that leads us to the logical explanation here is that ethanol must have been a major factor here. And so let's give the real simple version of the story first. Higher oil and gasoline prices increase the demand for and the prices of ethanol. Higher ethanol prices encourage more ethanol production. And more ethanol production means higher prices for corn and other crops. This is not very complicated economics so far. So let's look at some of the data, see if the data bears this out. Here are wholesale level prices for gasoline and for ethanol in Omaha, Nebraska. So common basing point, hopefully measuring about the same thing. And yes, for the most part, those prices have tended to move together over the last couple of years. When prices for gasoline were increasing over the last few months of 2007, early 2008, ethanol prices moved up as well. Last half of 2008, prices came down together. Of course, there's a bit of a separation there. For a while, gasoline prices were above ethanol prices. That reversed itself in late 2008. Now we're back again to a situation where wholesale level prices for ethanol are lower than wholesale level prices for gasoline on a per gallon basis. So here's where I think is the key to the longer run economics of ethanol, not the short run, but the longer run economics of ethanol. And it just so happens that if I pick August 2009 data, it tells my story very well. Again, it's a little bit of cherry picking here, I'll be the first to admit, but this tells the story well for where we might be longer term. In August of 2009, the average wholesale price of gasoline in Omaha, Nebraska was $2 a gallon. The average retail price for the country as a whole for August was $2.63. So taxes and other markups between the wholesale and retail level, therefore accounted for about 63 cents per gallon. So that takes care of the first column now. Second column, let's suppose you have a 10% ethanol blend. You know, what goes into making that 10% ethanol blend? Well, you still have to pay $2 for the gasoline, for every gasoline you use. The wholesale ethanol price in the month of August was $1.72 in Omaha. For every gallon that a blender of ethanol, a blender puts into a gallon into motor fuel, for every gallon of ethanol he puts into motor fuel, he gets a tax credit of 45 cents. So it has the effect of reducing the cost to a blender of fuel if he uses ethanol by 45 cents per gallon. So if it's $1.72 at the wholesale level, the cost to the blender of that fuel is effectively $1.27 in the month of August 2009. So if you take the net wholesale cost, therefore, of preparing a blended fuel, it'd be 90% times the $2 gasoline price, plus 10% multiplied by the $1.27 ethanol price at the wholesale level, net of the tax credit. And so therefore, that overall cost is $1.93. Let's assume, for sake of argument, that the overall net taxes and markup rolled between wholesale and retail is about the same for regular gasoline as this for 10% blends. That would be true in most states, not everywhere, but for the most part, that's going to be roughly true. That would give you a retail cost of $2.56 per gallon. So if you were just pricing the gasoline or the blended gasoline with ethanol the same way you're pricing regular gasoline, the retail price should have been $2.56. Well, lo and behold, $2.56 is about 97% of the price of regular gasoline. Again, ethanol has roughly two-thirds of the BTUs on a per-gallon basis as regular gasoline does. That means a 10% blend will have about 97% of the calories, 97% of the BTUs, if you will, of regular gasoline. So guess what? In August 2009, ethanol was priced almost exactly as it should be, if you will, in order to reflect ethanol's energy value, given the policies that are in place. So that's about the relationship you expect to hold in the long term. Now, in the near term, lots of reasons that's not going to be true all the time. But if you're talking 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, that's the relationship you expect to see longer term to prevail. Now let's look at what happens. Take that economics now to the plant that actually produces ethanol from corn. We're doing a corn-based plant here, making a dry mill process that's going to make ethanol and distillers grains as a co-product. In 2008, 2009, the year that started September 1, 2008, and just ended August 31st of this year, the average price of ethanol was $1.87. The value of distillers grains that a plant could sell, doing a little bit of math, is about 38 cents. So the total revenue of a plant would be $2.25 per gallon of ethanol produced. Corn's average price last marketing year was $4.06 per bushel for the year as a whole, for the country as a whole. National average was about 2.72 gallons of ethanol per bushel of corn. So therefore, the cost of corn for that plant was about $1.49 if it paid the national average price for corn. Fuel electricity from natural gas and other sources, about 26 cents per gallon, give or take. Other operating costs for labor, et cetera, about 33 cents, give or take, per gallon. So it gives you a total operating cost of $2.08. So the net margin for that plant over its operating cost was a mere 17 cents per gallon. That's over operating costs before paying for the plant itself. And this is an average plant across the country. Some plants have higher operating costs. Some plants get lower ethanol prices. Some plants get lower DDG prices. Some plants are less efficient. So if you're on the bottom half of the scale on one or more of those categories I just listed, you may actually have lost money relative to operating costs last year and therefore should have shut down. Indeed, we had up to 2 billion gallons of capacity idle during part of the past year because the economics were so bad for some of the plants. On the other hand, there were some plants that were making more money than this. The cost of building a new plant works out to about 25 to 30 cents per gallon on an annualized basis. So that return was not enough to make anybody want to build a new plant. Indeed, almost no new plants have been started for the last 2 years. So corn prices in 2008, 2009 were about as high as they possibly could have been, given ethanol prices. If we tried to have a corn price higher than we saw last year, even more ethanol plants would have lost money, even more ethanol plants would have shut down. That would have meant less demand for ethanol, less demand for corn to make ethanol, I should say, and therefore lower corn prices. So we had kind of a natural top to how high corn prices could be last year, given where ethanol prices were. So in the long run, corn prices cannot be so high that all ethanol plants lose money, nor so low that ethanol production is usually profitable. So if you buy this rationale that the petroleum price largely determines the gasoline price, the gasoline price and policies largely determine the ethanol price, and the ethanol price in the long run at least determines the corn price, cut through those steps, the petroleum price in the long run determines the corn price. It won't be true every year, every month, every day, but over the long run, those two markets have to be linked as long as policies don't screw things up. So here's our projections of the margins for a typical ethanol plant. Again, the top lines that we talked about, that's the ethanol price plus the distiller's grains value. The red line of the operating costs are primarily the cost of corn, but also other operating costs for the plant. And the green line on the bottom is the net return for those plants. Note how huge the profits were for those typical plants back in 2005 and 2006. If you built a plant that started operation September 1, 2005, that plant could have been fully paid for 2 years later. It's no wonder we built a lot of ethanol plants during that period of time. It was a hugely profitable enterprise. But if there's one basic rule of economics I want you to learn today is that abnormal profits can't last. So when you have those kind of profits, everybody builds, you overbuild eventually until those profits go away. And we expect in our projections out to the future that those margins remain relatively tight in front of us. So let's walk through how this affects the other markets. So again, more ethanol production means higher corn prices. Higher corn prices mean more production of corn, which means something else has to give. In the case of 2007, what gave was less soybeans. We planted a lot less soybeans in 2007 than we had the previous year, primarily because of all the land shifting to corn production. It's also true for wheat and other crops. Higher corn prices mean less non-ethanol use of corn, more use of other crops. Results is higher prices for all those other crops. If you have higher corn prices and higher prices for the other feeds, that means you're going to have higher crops. Other crops mean you're going to have higher feed costs overall. Higher feed costs are going to reduce profitability of the livestock sector, as we've seen greatly the last couple of years. I mean, livestock producers kind of across the board are losing money the last 2 years. That can't last forever. Eventually, some or all of them will scale back. Some will stop production entirely. And when they stop production, there'll be less overall available supplies of livestock. That'll result in higher livestock prices. Okay, that was a simplified version of the story. I don't have time to even dream about giving you the full story. Literally, I've written a book about this. I'm not kidding. Grain prices rose between 2005 and middle of 2008 for a whole lot of reasons not tied to ethanol. We have poor crops in Europe and Australia. We had a weaker dollar, I mentioned already. Strong global economic growth in the first part of that period, and policies that exacerbated price swings in many countries. Almost every single one of those factors that I just listed reversed course in the last half of 2008, now pushes prices back down again. So that's what we've seen over the last 2 years. So ethanol policies and how they affect the market. There's a tax credit of 45 cents per gallon of every gallon of ethanol that's blended with motor fuels, I said before. This has the effect of pushing up the price at an ethanol plant and pushing down the price to a consumer. There's a tariff of 54 cents per gallon of ethanol that comes directly from Brazil. So that has the effect of protecting the domestic market for ethanol, lets our prices for ethanol typically be higher than the price in Brazil. Although I will say the last couple of months, our prices and Brazilian prices have been almost identical because the very high sugar prices in Brazil have raised the cost of producing ethanol in Brazil dramatically. And then very important, of course, is the renewable fuel standard. This is a very simplified version of the renewable fuel standard set in place by the 2007 energy bill. It sets aside a certain amount of ethanol, or biofuels, I should say, needs to be consumed every year in this country for the through 2022, reaching 36 billion gallons total by 2022. The blue part of the bar there is the portion that can come from conventional corn-based ethanol. If you produce more corn-based ethanol than that, that's okay. There's no rule against it, but does not count towards meeting the mandate. So only 15 billion gallons eventually of corn-based ethanol can count towards meeting this requirement. The red bar is supposed to primarily be cellulosic ethanol by the end, by the year 2022, we're supposed to have 16 billion gallons of cellulosic ethanol. We'll see if we get there from here. How much difference has the RFS made? Well, you could spin this different ways. I could spin this by pointing especially to the first 3 years shown here in this chart and say, not much difference at all. In 2006, 2007, and 2008, the RFS in blue was less by a fair amount than the actual level of biofuel consumption in this country. We were voluntarily, if you will, consuming more ethanol than required for those 3 years. In fact, quite a bit more the first couple of years, especially in 2007 and part of 2008. When you've got $120, $140 petroleum, you're going to use as much ethanol as you can, and we did. Now in 2009, things have changed. And now we have a situation where, given where petroleum prices were, especially earlier this year, a lot of folks didn't want to use ethanol unless they were forced to, and they were forced to by the RFS. So this year's ethanol consumption will probably be roughly the amount that's required to satisfy the mandate and not much more. With the RFS in place, at least the required quantities of biofuels must be used over time. The ethanol price to producers and importers must be set high enough to get them to want to provide at least the required supplies. And that's the way the RFS works. It matters when it requires more ethanol use than would have resulted otherwise. So if there's a small corn crop, for example, because of bad yields, of, you know, bad weather situation, if there are low gasoline prices, if there's strong corn export demand, under those types of circumstances, the RFS is very important. If you take away the RFS, ethanol prices must be at levels that result in voluntary use of available supplies. And if you have really cheap petroleum, really cheap gasoline, that'll be a very low price, might result in less ethanol production and consumption that would result with the RFS in place. So going back to that first chart I showed you, I'd argue that that period in the circle there, between about this time last year and earlier this summer, was a period of time where the RFS mattered a lot. We were artificially keeping the price of ethanol higher than it would have been in the market because people knew they had to use a certain amount of ethanol to satisfy the requirement. Now that corn production appears to be pretty good this year and gasoline prices have come back up again, lo and behold, we're back now to where we're in a more normal relationship between those two things. The RFS is probably not very important right now. It's actually the ethanol or the gasoline price that's probably driving the corn market much more than the case previously. Another very important issue in the market is what's going to happen as we satisfy the demand for 10% blends in this country. In our model, we separate ethanol consumption into three components. The green part on the bottom is the amount that's kind of required by law, or at least required to satisfy clean air requirements in places like Chicago, New York, California, et cetera. So where people pretty much have to use ethanol just to satisfy clean air requirements. The yellow portion is the portion where people are buying ethanol because, you know, 10% blends, because it appears to be the more affordable fuel, if you will. And that's become a much more important part of the market in recent years. We currently consume about 138 billion gallons of motor fuel in this country, motor gasoline in this country. So 10% of that's 13.8 billion gallons. So unless gasoline consumption is going to rise a lot, you can't consume more than about 13 or 14 billion gallons of ethanol longer term if all you're using is 10% blends, even if every single gallon in the country is a 10% blend, which is unlikely in and of itself. So sooner or later, you need to have higher level blends, whether it's a 15% blend that people have talked about for this year, or whether it's E85 that's legal now, of course, but not very attractive to many folks and certainly not feasible because of lack of cars, lack of service stations today. But over time, that has to become an important part of the market, especially if we're going to grow to something like the 36 billion gallons anticipated by 2022. In our baseline projections prepared back in August, and we tried to weigh all the economics of the various things that are at play here, and in our projections, almost all the ethanol production does come from corn over the next several years. We are trying to look more carefully at switchgrass and Stover economics right now, but frankly, given what we're seeing as the current economic situation, it doesn't look terribly attractive. If we're going to produce much from either of those sources anytime soon, it's frankly going to be because of subsidies. We're paying more for ethanol from those already than we're paying for conventional ethanol, and it's only that way that's ever going to become profitable unless there's a major technological breakthrough, it appears to us. Ethanol imports are a relatively small portion of the overall total picture. So we look at the big picture for corn. Again, the top line there is the amount of corn we feed directly to animals as corn. The bottom line in red is the amount of corn that we export each year. And the growing line, of course, is the amount that we're using that's going into ethanol plants. And you can see we went from having ethanol consumption being a relatively small part of the overall picture to exceeding corn exports for the first time in 2007, 2008, to perhaps getting near overall feed use of corn by the time we get to 2014 or so. So a very dramatically picture, dramatically changing story in a short period of time. One thing I heard this morning that I might take a little bit of exception to is, you know, the concern that we need to have a whole lot more acres of corn in order to be able to satisfy this growing demand. Well, it depends on your point of reference, I suppose. If your point of reference is before 2007, yes, we need more corn acres to satisfy this demand. But if your point of reference is 2007, no, not probably not. In our projections, we never get back to 2007 level corn acreage in this country. If you have continued increases in corn yields over time, less direct consumption of corn as grain for feed because of the displacement from distillers grains, and only the levels of ethanol consumption are anticipated under the RFS, we don't see much more reason to see corn acreage ever exceeding about 91 million acres. Now, that's a lot of corn by historical standards, but no more than we saw in 2007. Okay. Soybeans, you can see, 75, 80 million acres, declining wheat acres over time, mostly because of increased competition from other countries. In interest of time, let me try to go through this one fairly quickly. We've done a lot of analysis of what happens if you take away certain parts of this package of policies that we have. And an important economic conclusion of this is that some of our current policies are redundant. If you take away just one of the pieces of the puzzle, it doesn't affect things as much as if you take away all the pieces put together. So, for example, if you just take away the RFS, we estimate that on average over the next 8 years, across 500 different ways the future could happen, that we would reduce ethanol production by about 12%, the corn price by about 5%, corn acres about 2.3 million acres, and total acres devoted to 12 major crops and hay by about 800,000 acres. You can see the numbers for taking away the blender's credit, taking away the ethanol tariff, and then look what happens if you remove all three at the same time on the right-hand side there. That effect of removing all of them at the same time is greater than some of the parts, because there are times where just either the ethanol tariff or the ethanol credit or the RFS is what matters the most to the market. If you take away all of our current federal level supports for the ethanol industry, we still produce ethanol. Story number one. We don't stop producing ethanol if you take away current support policies. We reduce it a lot by 36%, but we don't stop entirely by any means. Corn prices fall by 13%. Corn acreage falls by 6.5 million acres. And the total amount of land used for crop production in the U.S. drops about 2.2 million acres. For perspective, that's less than 1%. So yes, there are some, you know, there are effects on overall land use, but they're not perhaps quite as dramatic as some people might have had you believe. These averages can themselves be deceiving. What matters most depends on circumstances. When oil prices and corn yields are high, the RFS is not likely to matter very much. Tax credits encourage ethanol production use in that circumstance. However, when oil prices and corn yields are both low at the same time, the RFS may make a very large difference by putting a floor beneath demand, and the tax credit may not make a lot of difference. This is, and again, what are petroleum prices going to be? We don't know. And if anybody in this room knows, they can make a lot of money, obviously, if they know what's going to happen to petroleum prices. When we do our projections, we take our projections for petroleum markets from a group called the IHS Global Insight, private forecasting group that makes lots of money doing forecasts, and they're as wrong as anybody else. And so here are their projections over the last couple years. The very top line there is where they were last August of 2008, and their forecast for oil prices over $120 a barrel, as far as the eye can see. That didn't seem like a crazy projection back then. That's where futures markets were at that time. Then, of course, the whole bottom falls out of the overall global economy and out of petroleum markets. And so the green line on the very bottom there in 2009 is where we were as recently as January of this year, as their projections. Now, the line that's kind of in the middle, the reddish line in the middle there, that's where their numbers were in July. I've just now seen their October numbers. They move up a little bit further from what you see there. And then finally, the yellowish-greenish line there, that's the NYMEX futures, the futures market for petroleum over the next several years. Who knows where petroleum prices are going to be? You know, so we look at a range of possible outcomes of what those might mean for the market. I think I won't talk about this one in detail, but just say that we looked at, for example, how these different policies affect the market, depending on the price of petroleum, and it mattered a lot. The growth in ethanol use, it reduces the demand for conventional gasoline, so there are effects going the other way as well. So if we have more biofuel production, it means less demand for gasoline. That means all else equal, at least some reduction in gasoline prices. That means the Midwestern drought that reduces ethanol production will have some impact on gasoline prices now, something we wouldn't have thought possible just a few years ago, but now it is actually a big enough factor that it really does matter, at least a little bit. But let's be careful in saying how much it matters. Here's U.S. ethanol use as a share of total motor gasoline use in the United States, the blue line being by volume, the red line being by BTUs. So currently we're at about 8%, give or take, by volume, and we're expected to grow past 10% by about 2012, 2013 under current laws by volume. But that's only about, you know, it's two-thirds of that amount on a BTU basis. So that's big enough to make a difference. You know, every little percent matters in terms of overall gasoline prices and overall petroleum prices. But let's not exaggerate how important biofuels are in the overall mix of fuels in this country. It's still relatively small. As I said, biofuel production does use fossil fuels, of course, as well. Diesel to run the tractors, natural gas to make the nitrogen fertilizer, et cetera, et cetera. But it does clearly reduce the consumption of regular gasoline. So to sum up, the growth of biofuels industry means the energy and agricultural markets are much more closely linked than would have been the case ever in the past. Policies encourage biofuel production use, but they have complex, context-dependent effects on the market. Biofuel production has at least some modest impact on the markets for fossil fuels as well. So with that, take any questions you might have. Sure. Well, I do think poultry has adjusted actually fairly quickly. Poultry actually pulled back production for the first time ever a couple years ago, and they have actually got their prices back to where at least most poultry producers can now make money again. So they have actually done this successfully. And of course, poultry has a very short life, so you can do that more rapidly for poultry than you can for other industries. Pork has probably been the biggest mystery. You know, pork, I think the pork guys made a lot of money in 2006. They made pretty good money in 2007, even the first part of 2008, even in spite of higher ethanol prices and higher corn prices, because they were able to sell a lot of pork overseas. But then when the global economy collapsed late last year, that all went the wrong way, obviously. And there's been massive red ink in the pork industry over the last 18 months. Somebody's going to give very soon. Some people are starting to give already. There's a lot of people hoping for economic recovery to change that. Beef, of course, much longer cycle. And so beef, it's going to be a while before we work ourselves out of this unless we have a lot stronger demand for beef longer term. Dairy made tons of money in 2007, early 2008, losing tons of money this year.
I just made a comment about the pork industry in Canada. Now, this year, we have a government policy to help hog farmers permanently move out of the business because of this crisis.
Right. Sure, I don't have a table, I guess, with me here today, but you know, our overall, we keep an overall balance of all the feeds in the country, at least all the major feeds. And so if you look on a per unit of livestock basis, it's pretty flat over time. A little bit of variability based on weather and other things like that, but most were pretty flat. We've seen a major displacement of you know, you see the drop in corn use for feed here a little bit. There's been an also drop in soybean meal use the last several years because of increased distillers grains use. But the total amount of livestock feed hasn't changed very much. And we don't expect to see that in the future. I think a lot of people thought that we were going to have a hard time, you know, satisfying the demands of animal agriculture. We can do it, just at a price. You know, you will get people to produce the amount of corn we need, or, you know, that we can satisfy those demands, but it won't be $2 corn, as we've seen. Sure. Yeah, there's lots of sweet sorghums. And one of the things people have talked about, switchgrass, Dover, it's been talked about as other feedstocks, obviously. And sugar is obviously already a very major feedstock in Brazil and elsewhere. So there are multiple pathways that will get you to more biofuel production in the longer run. Which of those wins out, of course, will depend on the economics more than anything else, I will argue. I mean, yes, there's lots of technological things that have to work through, but let's not lose sight of the economics. And going back to this chart here, if I can find it back quickly, this one right about here, you know, this is the basic driver here. Anytime you're getting a large return over operating cost for ethanol made from corn, you're going to make more ethanol from corn. And until something else can make ethanol more cheaply, that's what you're going to do. It's only because of policies you'd ever even dream of doing something else. I mean, let's be clear, right now, there's a reason we don't make ethanol from switchgrass. There's a reason we don't make ethanol from sugar in this country. It's too expensive. This is the most profitable way to make ethanol in this country by far today. Now, changing technology may well change that, but we're not there yet. We're not even close to being there yet. And it's going to take big changes for that to, you know, for that to occur over time.
I don't agree that you said that so far using corn for ethanol is the best way.
I didn't say best. I said most profitable.
Yeah.
Very different thing. Yeah, sure. My point is a really simple, very simple one. Unless you pass a law saying you shall not make ethanol from corn, or unless you change the law that currently provides a subsidy to ethanol production, this is what you're going to get. People are going to make ethanol if it's profitable. Right now, or until about a year ago, it was very profitable. Right now, it's not so profitable. Some people aren't building new plants today, but it is still profitable to operate most existing plants. Going forward, if there's large profits in the industry, people will build more plants, they'll make more ethanol from corn. If there's something else that can make ethanol more cheaply, they'll make it more cheaply from something else. Right now, there is nothing else that makes ethanol more cheaply in this country. Sugar is cheaper in Brazil to make ethanol from, but that's because sugar is cheaper in Brazil than it is here by far, normally. And so therefore, it makes sense to make ethanol from sugar in Brazil. Here, it does not. Sweet sorghum may work longer term, doesn't work yet. Yeah, that would have been a very legitimate argument 2 or 3 years ago, because corn farmers were getting a lot of their income from the government. That's not true anymore. I mean, the overall level of last year, the average per acre return for corn on a gross sense was about $600 an acre. Of that, $20 came from the government. You could take that away and frankly nothing would change. You know, it used to be important, it's not anymore. I mean, yes, people make that argument, it's really not the story anymore. I mean, the one that the policy that does matter is if you didn't have tariffs on imports of sugar, under normal circumstances, we would import sugar and we would make ethanol from that. But we have tariffs on sugar, and right now sugar is expensive anyway.
Thank you. Appreciate it.